Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday, the 25th of September. It's an absolute pleasure to be in your company this morning. I thank you all for being here. Thank you for the wonderful work you did this morning with the lockbox and listening to Ray and Sarah and answering the call. And we appreciate that more than you'll ever know. And we'll continue that this morning. Sarah and I will be along about 11:30, and we'll have some more breaks throughout the morning. And it's a very important thing for us and certainly for this radio station. So we thank you so much for doing that. Good morning, all. We have a great group this morning. I want to introduce them to you. And a quick shout out. I want to thank the folks at both Oblong Books and the Bardavon for hosting an event last night with author Ken Follett. And I interviewed Ken on stage at the Bardavon. And first of all, the Bardavon, one of the most beautiful theaters ever. Just absolutely gorgeous. And so that was great. And Ken was great. And all of the people involved were great. We had a nice audience, a couple hundred people. That was fantastic. Really nice to see everybody. A lot of WAMCers. One woman was yelling at me as I was getting into my car. She said, "I'll give to the lockbox in the morning." And I thought, "There you go. We've made our match." One other thing I want to mention, real quick, because this is coming up, and with all the fun drive and everything, if you missed me in Bardavon last night, I'll be back. Listen to this. On October 11th, they're going to have the Eleanor Roosevelt Band Book Awards, the Eleanor Roosevelt Center in partnership with PEN America, and they are presenting Lifetime Achievement Award to Margaret Atwood of the Handmaid's Tale fame. And I will be having, this is their term for it, a fireside chat. See what they did there? A fireside chat with Margaret Atwood.
What instrument are you going to play in the Eleanor Roosevelt band?
That's a very good question. That's a very good question. If you want to find out more, go to bardavon.org, and it should be just an amazing evening. And Margaret Atwood has a lovely, incredible new memoir coming out. And this, I believe, is the only appearance she's doing in the United States of America. So because she's Canadian, and I'm just drawing my own conclusions. Okay, so there's that. Let me introduce the group to you. It was cool, though. Ira, I got to your neck of the woods. Ira, long time with the Kingston Freeman. And I did the event in Poughkeepsie. I stayed last night in Kingston. And here's what I loved about it. They got Channel 7, so I got to watch Kimmel.
Oh, That's just a new slogan now. There's something for everyone in Kingston.
I was so excited because here in Albany we can get Jimmy Kimmel because of Nextstar, but there down in Kingston, Channel 7, right out of the city.
Channel 6 is also owned by one of the
by Sinclair.
By
yeah.
Sinclair. They didn't. They.
But they're an ABC affiliate.
Yeah, but they didn't do anything with the Colbert.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I apologize. CBS affiliate. Yes. No, they didn't do anything with the Colbert.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ira Fussfeld is here, publisher emeritus of the Daily Freeman, and very nice to have you with
Thank
us.
Thank you. Good to see you. Hello to everybody.
We have Emily Honan with us, a grants analyst, someone who I'm sure you probably have a couple things to say about the looming shutdown and such.
You know what? I couldn't think of anything to say. You know, I have no opinion on the situation, no comment, move on.
It's great to have you here as always.
Thank you.
We always love when you're part of the program. Nick Rangel joins us, executive director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning. It's really great to be here. We're very excited about our upcoming Justice for All Awards on October 11th.
Same day. Yeah.
noted, the looming shutdown obviously is weighing pretty heavy on nonprofit organizations, and so it is a great time to support nonprofits.
Absolutely. And, of course, Legal Aid Society, you can simply look. It's LASNY.org.
And
LASNY.org.
Folks should check out our excellent six honorees that we'll be honoring at the Canfield Casino in Saratoga that night.
Ooh, very nice.
Exciting.
A beautiful evening. Yeah. Wonderful. Catherine Tan is with us, associate professor. Professor or associate professor?
Associate professor.
Okay, associate professor. One of our associate professors changed to professor and told me about it, and now I think everyone got an upgrade. I apologize. Associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College. Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
A delight to have you here. All right, let's talk about the news of the day and what's making news this morning. And it is, we have a lot to talk about, as we seems to be the case here most days, isn't it? But I think
it is what makes the show, Joe.
I know. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because I do remember you, of course, Ira. You did this for so many years. You know, there were some days you walk in, there's like, whoa. What are we going to fill it with today?
You mean with here or at the newspaper?
Well, at the newspaper.
Yeah, the newspaper. One of the great things about newspapers used to be that you'd start every day with blank sheets of paper and you just keep filling them up. But some days are harder than others.
Not the case these days.
No,
not the case these days at all. We're going to talk about the shutdown crisis. I don't know if crisis, I don't, maybe that's an overkill. I really don't know. But for the purposes of this conversation, the New York Times is labeling it a crisis. We'll continue. We'll call it a crisis. It may very well end up in a shutdown. So here we go. President Trump's decision this week to abruptly cancel a meeting with top Democrats aimed at averting a government shutdown within days highlighted the toxic relationship helping drive Congress and the White House toward a crisis. With a Republican governing trifecta, Mr. Trump has adopted a go-it-alone approach at the dawn of his second term, freezing out Democrats and never once inviting their leaders to the White House for negotiations or anything else. With Democrats opposing him at every turn, the president has been able to rely exclusively on Republicans to push through his big priorities, including enacting a major tax cut and domestic policy bill, clawing back billions in congressionally approved spending, and winning confirmation of his nominees. That will not be the case when it comes to funding the government, which Congress must do by Tuesday to avoid a shutdown. Because Republicans have only a narrow majority in the Senate, passing a government spending bill that can win the necessary 60 votes depends on attracting at least a small amount of Democratic support. That will require bipartisan negotiation, an art that has been fading steadily on Capitol Hill, and so far has been lost altogether during the second term of Mr. Trump. Even talks around whether and when to meet have prompted a round of recriminations and finger-pointing. Mr. Trump said earlier this month that Republicans should not even bother negotiating with Democrats and suggested his party could fund the government solely with Republican votes. The characterization infuriated Democrats who have demanded that any measure to extend spending also carry more than $1 trillion to continue Obamacare subsidies and reverse cuts to Medicaid and other health programs that Republicans made over the summer. Mr. Trump canceled the meeting after a call with Speaker Mike Johnson and Senator John Thune of South Dakota, the majority leader, who urged the president not to meet with Democratic leaders. Mr. Johnson has told reporters before the meeting was canceled that he was not certain it was necessary. So, how do you negotiate, Nick Rangel, if you're not meeting with the people that you need to negotiate with?
To be fair, it's the staff behind the scenes doing the vast majority of the negotiations at the tables. I think the public conversations between leaders, there's a strategy that makes it appear that they're not talking behind the scenes, but also there's some sense that the Republican leadership are sort of afraid that the president will back them into the corner on things and get out ahead of the Republican leadership in Congress. And so I think they're trying to contain any potential slip-ups that the president might make in that kind of meeting. That's not to say that staff aren't working on language at the tables, not in public. I think what's kind of more interesting is that the House went on recess after passing the continuing resolution, which makes it actually more difficult to get the members in front of legislation to review that language and provide feedback to the staff. So the recess itself, I think, is actually the bigger delay.
So what do you think will happen?
Oh, I think we're going to have a shutdown. I mean, I don't think this party is afraid of a shutdown. I don't think Donald Trump is afraid of a shutdown. I think they are very confident that their messaging will be able to both avoid a confrontational response to the shutdown, and that they'll be able to continue to sort of flood the zone with these other sort of circus shows going on.
Yeah, Emily. I definitely agree with the sort of like distraction tactic. And I also think it's very transparent what they're trying to do with getting Trump out of the room with Democrats, because they're afraid he's just going to change his mind or say something crazy and then they'll have a whole new thing to worry about. I think they're much more like, no, let us do this behind the scenes. And unfortunately, I feel like the Democrats are put in a pretty difficult situation, because passing the continuing resolution is also not very popular. I mean, they try to frame it in a way that's like, oh, we're preventing this shutdown, we're doing good. But also, it's defunding a lot of programs that people really need. I mean, I remember when the last continuing resolution was passed, that was, I wouldn't say catastrophic, but it was very, very stressful for a lot of the communities that I work with that were depending on earmarks for things like, and I mean, these are not necessarily Democratic communities, I would say. I mean, these are people who probably voted for this, and now they don't get water and don't get sewer because of all this just like infighting. And I think it really speaks to the human element of the whole problem.
Catherine?
I think Democrats don't really have much of a choice but to kind of hold strong here, because this is an opportunity to backtrack the many things that are getting cut because of the big, beautiful bill. What I'm wondering is, like, if we do have, and this is a question that's probably better answered by the two of you, if we do have a government shutdown, I mean, oftentimes when that happens, fingers are pointed at, like, the president. So Trump, being someone who likes to deflect blame and to just dodge any sort of criticism that comes his way, how do you see him handling this? Because if you see a shutdown as being perhaps almost inevitable, like, yeah, how I'm just curious, like, you know, he's not meeting with Democrats to talk through the bills, like, so how do you anticipate him managing?
I think it's a bygone conclusion that the Democrats will be blamed and no one will question it, because the facts don't matter anymore in this administration. They never really have. I mean, he can just say, well, he can directly say, I wanted to meet with the Democrats, but they refused. And people will believe that, even if you throw the truth in his face. So that's why I think the Democrats are in a pretty bad situation, which, like, no matter what they do, they're going to be blamed, and people are going to believe that, unfortunately.
Right. So even if there are compromises, then their own party is going to say, well, why would you do that, right?
Yeah,
like, this
exactly.
was an opportunity to save some of the things that were lost. And if they hold steady, then...
A point that was made on yesterday's program, unless you think I don't listen to what you actually say, that was that you have a Republican Congress, you have a Republican Senate, and you have a Republican president, and you're going to blame the Democrats.
Mm-hmm. They will, and they'll get away with it.
Well, I have concocted a roadmap that has no chance in hell of ever happening. But
I love those.
I think that Trump... again, I'm not an idiot. I know this is not going to happen, but bear with me. Trump has been shamelessly campaigning to get a Nobel Peace Prize because he's allegedly solved seven wars. Well, he should be turning inward and looking at this country and seeing how divided it is, in large part but not entirely of his own making. And the roadmap is that he's going to come into the Oval Office and he's going to command the network attention, and he's going to say, a new day has dawned in this country. I'm not going to call people names anymore. I'm not going to refuse to meet people anymore who I should be meeting with for a bipartisan solution to this and other problems. And I'm calling in the leadership of the House and the Senate, and we're going to get together and we're going to solve this. And sure, it's not going to be easy. We do have legitimate policy differences. But I want to eliminate all the auxiliary crap that is muddying the waters. And by the way, if we're successful in this initiative and we get ourselves a budget and avoid a shutdown, or at least minimize the amount of time a shutdown entails, let's try this with all various other issues that we have facing us. And then I'll nominate myself for a Nobel Peace Prize because I brought peace to America.
And then Tiny Tim sits on his lap and says, God bless him, everyone.
I haven't had anything to drink yet this morning other than water.
Well, it sounds good. Let's take a break. We will pause. And when we return, we'll continue the conversation. We welcome your letters as we always do. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.e. Wow. No one knows what I just did, but what I almost did was give you the call letters for a radio station that I worked at 40 years ago. So there you go. man. WAMC.org. We will be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Interesting letter from Deborah as we talk about the shutdown crisis and the possibility of a shutdown coming October 1st, which will be this coming Tuesday. Deborah writes, the government is already partially shut down. Look at the cutbacks, the firings, the aid withdrawals. I don't have to rehash it. A typical tactic trying to stoke fear. Democrats need to stand tall and, quote unquote, claw back healthcare. It's an interesting point that there is so much of government that has been eliminated, gutted, stopped, not funded.
Nick was discussing how this would be difficult for nonprofits, and it's like, well, it already kind of has been. Some have already been completely defunded.
Oh, we're in that. Yeah. Including us.
I feel like you know about that.
Yes, I know something about that. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so a federal shutdown would have kind of various impacts on some agencies. Non-emergency funding would stop or pause for that period of time. Emergency funding would generally continue. Organizations that are already funded would continue to get the money that they've already distributed or awarded. So for our organization, Legal Aid Society, the LSC organization, which is funded by Congress but is a separate nonprofit, it has its money already and will be able to continue to make payments on our grant for 3 months. The longest shutdown was in 2018 under the previous Trump administration. That was 35 days. So, you know, the analysts are thinking, sure, there may be a shutdown. We've seen shutdowns many times in the last couple of decades. It's almost routine, which is really sad to consider. But, you know, worst case scenario, you can expect something to be adopted or passed before the end of that, like, 3 month sort of soft landing space. What I would know, what I sort of the thought popped in my head is that the Democratic Party is not typically able or like disciplined enough to keep all of its members from making decisions on how to vote independently. Mm-hmm. We know, for example, John Fetterman voted in support of the continuing resolution to keep funding flat. And so I do suspect that marginal members or members who are moderate or kind of lean conservative, even as they identify as Democrats in the caucus, are likely to support some kind of continuing resolution that would actually keep funding flat during that that CR period. The continuing resolution that the House passed was what's called a clean CR. It does not change funding levels except that it increases security for certain agencies. So there are some Democrats who think that a CR is not as toxic as the party, I think, is describing it as.
You think the Democrats are doing a good job explaining their position?
No.
No, that's it. We were talking about this last week when I was here, and I think there was a consensus that the Democrats' message, again, is muddled, and it needs to find the right message and the right spokespeople to describe the message. Or else they're just gonna wither away, and perhaps they're waiting for Trump to say, okay, we're gonna lay off thousands of more people, and then they'll blame the Republicans and the Democrats will prevail. But I'm not confident in that, and I'm still of the mind that the Democrats are not explaining to the American people well enough what their position is and why it's the right position.
Yeah, I agree. They can be a lot noisier right now about how Trump is unwilling to meet with them and to reach some kind of resolution, and also amplify that what they're trying to do is like restore cuts to Medicaid, which is so important. It's going to impact like millions of people. And These are important points that need to be, blown up a little bit bigger.
I think the challenge with the messaging around Medicaid is that the majority of the cuts don't happen until 2027, until after midterms. And so it's difficult to tie today's shutdown to a future possibility. Yeah. There would be hypothetically many opportunities before those changes take effect for a Democratic majority to take back the House or the Senate and reverse or pass legislation on its own to undo those changes, those future changes, or repeal those future changes. And so for people right now, they're not seeing a direct and immediate correlation. There are people who are having a harder time getting Social Security, but it's because of the shift in its spending away from frontline workers towards their 800 phone number and their other sort of tech-centered projects and the closure of offices and new requirements to come and prove your identity in person. And then, identity mistakes in documentation of people's living status, as in people are being designated as deceased. So those are real, but they're not impacting enough people to change the trajectory of the Democratic messaging.
Let's go to a few letters in the time we have before the top of the hour break. Elaine says, I'm afraid that a shutdown will give executive orders and actions back to the president. He's got them now, right?
Have they been taken away?
Yeah, I mean, I understand the point of the letter, and it's a good one, because I'm sure Elaine's right that it will increase, but it's not like we don't already have been living with that over the last 10 months. Mm-hmm.
Like, are they saying that it make it more legitimate? I mean, he doesn't need legitimacy. He doesn't care about that.
I don't know, but I'm guessing that's. Ruth said, go ahead.
I think what's interesting is so we have executive orders that set out the president's priorities and initiatives, and then he has people in place in all these agencies that are willing to act on that, or a Supreme Court that's allowing him to make unilateral decisions about congressional appointments. So whether an agency's funded or not is almost irrelevant if he tells the the secretary of that agency to fire 30% of its staff. They're going to do that. Like, just because the appropriation is made doesn't mean the agency has to spend it. So, the moves will be made either way. The funding is an approval of spending. It's not a prohibition of not spending.
Mm-hmm. That seems, you want Captain Obvious here? That seems very broken.
I mean, it's, yeah.
hasn't there been?
I don't think it's good.
It just means smoke and mirrors. Like you set it up and you say, okay, well, we're gonna go play CR. We're gonna go play continuing resolution, and we just want everybody to know that whatever you decide where you can spend, we can take that away. We can abolish the department. We can do away with it, and we're done.
Well, so what he's actually directed his agencies to do is to fire any position that doesn't align with his priorities or his preferences, his positions and beliefs, right, that aren't specifically required by statute. So there's a number of positions that exist in statute, and then there are positions that agencies create in order to facilitate its mission. He's already directed agencies to cut positions and cut staff that are administrative in nature, that are not specifically created under statute, and a budget bill or a CR or any other legislation, if it doesn't require that the agency keep those people employed. So just like as an example, there are laws that specifically require state agencies in New York State to have a DEI office. It's a statute. It requires a DEI person, a person to be hired to do that work. What this administration is saying in the version of that at the federal level is unless the statute requires that, everybody else should be fired. And that isn't changing. That's existing law.
Right. We have a letter from Ruth. I got an email from my cousin in Norway today. She said most of her countrymen and women are appalled and confused about what's happening in the United States. She asked, quote, where are the Democrats? What can I tell her?
Wait, where's that Reductress article where it's like Democrats prevented from changing policy due to poll door marked push? And they're like, oh, we are being prevented from doing our duty. I mean, look at this. And then they all go home. Like, I feel bad about that. But also, like, they are in a terrible position. But yeah, as Ira was saying earlier, they don't really have a cohesive message. I mean, they Republicans are able to unite through hate. Mm-hmm. Sadly enough, the Democrats just don't have that. They've never really had the youth vote. We saw that back with Hillary. I mean, they just don't have something, you know, there's a lot of infighting. They don't really know what they're talking about, unfortunately.
We go to one more letter and then we'll send it over to Lockbox Central with David and Sarah. Deanne says, why do you say the Democrats will be blamed if there is a shutdown? Last spring, we didn't do a shutdown and gave up a lot. Many Democrats were angry about it. I think there are people who will recognize who is to blame and not just take the Republicans' word for it. We need to stand firm at some point, says Deanne.
Well, the Democrats will get the blame because the Senate is the last vote that it counts towards getting a bill passed or not passed, and they need Democratic votes. They, meaning the Republicans, need some Democratic votes, and if the Democrats don't give them those votes, they will be portrayed as blocking the entire effort.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. Ira Fussfeld is here. We have Nick Rangel, Emily Honan, and Catherine Tan. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue after this short break. Well, we're doing just fine. Thanks for asking. We welcome you back to the proceedings, and we have a great group here. We'll continue our conversation. We welcome you to join it. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Thanks to David and Sarah and Lockbox Central for the great work they're doing. Continue helping out that effort by going to WAMC.org, WAMC.org. And let's move on, shall we, to other topics that are making news on this Thursday morning. So there's two people that the president wants to put away. One is the elevator operator at the UN.
saying that he wants charges filed and wants it to be arrested.
Is that true?
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh.
Yeah. Yes. I love that you still have to ask that. But the other one, of course, is James Comey. The U.S. attorney is racing to present a case against James Comey. It remains to be seen whether a career prosecutor would be willing to present a case to a grand jury, or whether jurors would, how they would react to such a matter, whether jurors would bring an indictment once they actually hear it. President Trump's handpicked federal prosecutor in the Eastern District of Virginia is racing to present a case against James Comey, the former FBI director, to a grand jury before a deadline early next week, according to officials familiar with the situation. Lindsey Halligan, a former defense lawyer for Mr. Trump, who was hastily appointed after the president forced out her predecessor last week, is rushing to draft an indictment under withering pressure from the White House. The president has demanded the department go after one of his foremost enemies, even though career prosecutors determined there was insufficient evidence to indict Mr. Comey. Prosecutors have been looking into whether Mr. Comey should be charged with lying to Congress in connection to the FBI investigation of Mr. Trump's 2016 campaign and the ties to Russia, which the president claims was a witch hunt, that's right, and was aimed at destroying him. Halligan, who had no experience as a prosecutor before her recent appointment, could seek to bring charges as early as Thursday, but is expected to take action by Tuesday when the statute of limitations on Mr. Comey's congressional testimony expires, according to officials who requested anonymity to discuss an ongoing investigation. I am not poo-pooing this. I'm not saying that this will be the case here, but I am interested that in past cases that have come forward where indictments are sought, the court looks at them and says, wow, what, this doesn't make any sense. And you think of the pressure that they're under in a matter of days with somebody who's brand new and inexperienced. You just wonder what's going to come out of it.
I'm also very curious to see what's going to happen here because, I mean, you look at the facts, you're like, oh, there's no way this can happen. But we've said that about a lot of things. And we've put a lot of faith in the justice system because that's kind of like our last line of defense. And it hasn't been very defensive lately. I mean, you look at the facts, they're like, what are they even going to say? I mean, what evidence do they have? They have this woman who's never done this before, who has a week to prepare it.
She's an insurance lawyer, right?
Yeah, an insurance lawyer who's 8 years older than I am. And I mean, stranger things have happened. I'm just very interested to see how this plays out.
The Eastern District, like, they have failed to establish a probable cause of a crime. And so if they typically you only bring forward cases that are strong, right? So in this case, the line of defense would be the grand jury, right? And earlier in the month, the New York Times had this article about how grand juries have been throwing out a lot of cases, more so than in the past, especially cases that were brought forward about, on the immigration crackdown and also the arrests that were being made when troops were deployed to D.C. So there was there was protest against the cases that were not protest is not the right word, but there was resistance against the cases that were being brought forward. So I wonder if we might see something similar if they do bring this forward. Can we rely on a grand jury maybe tossing it out, saying this doesn't make sense, this doesn't hold, there isn't a case here?
Which is true.
Well, what's the old line? I'm sure Nick knows it better than I do. A good prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich. So generally speaking, it's not very hard to get an indictment. But, Trump is, as usual, nothing but transparent in his his thinking about this guy is he's an enemy. He wants retribution, and he's just going to keep pushing until he gets it, or until the court tells him he can't get it. But Comey, I don't think, has too many friends on either side of the aisle. So he's not a sympathetic figure, generally speaking. But nevertheless, if there's nothing to charge him with, then he shouldn't be charged.
I think what's interesting about the aggressive pursuit of an indictment here and also before Congress is that the allegations are so slim mm-hmm. on a matter that could blow up on mm-hmm. Republicans, right? Mm-hmm. So the allegation is that Comey specifically authorized the leak of information. But what it is tied to is the investigation into Russian interference on behalf of Donald Trump against Hillary Clinton. And so you have this extremely kind of minuscule, this minutia around, like, he said, I guess, that they have no evidence. They can't prove it. It's not like he wrote an email. Mm-hmm. He didn't tweet it. Mm-hmm. He certainly didn't put someone on a Signal thread on accident. Right. So, like, what is it that's being leaked, and how did that actually impact the investigation itself or the outcome? But then you have this possibility that that entire conversation is reopened yeah. with a Congress that's a little bit unhinged, I would say, in some cases. just, you know, views on my own. Anyway, so, you know, I think there's a real risk to the party, to the Republican Party, right. to relitigate a thing that Trump already won by virtue of being reelected. And this kind of goes back to other cases, right? Other allegations, other investigations that if he just moved on from, the American public has apparently not cared that much about it yeah. because they reelected him. And so, like, it doesn't make sense on a party level
As we all know, Trump is nothing if not retributive. He wants retribution against these people. And yeah. The way you outlined it, it doesn't make any sense for him to go after this guy. But that hasn't stood in his way before. So. Mm.
It's so emotional and yeah. short-sighted because you're right. Like, this can severely backfire and we can reinvestigate or reopen the case into examining Russia's interference in 2016. It's like you've already won twice. Like why? It's not even like why go after winning it all because you already did.
I mean, that's where this thing that Joe totally talked rational. About with the elevator, it at first blanch, it's shocked me. And then I realized, no, he'll sue the elevator guy, too.
Yeah. This is the President Trump Wednesday demanded an immediate investigation into what he claimed was triple sabotage. During his United Nations visit.
Sounds like a Barbara Stanwyck movie.
Triple sabotage. Citing a stopped escalator and a teleprompter that wasn't working. A real disgrace took place at the United Nations yesterday. Not one, not two, but three very sinister events. The people that did it should be arrested, he continued. So that was from the Post yesterday.
What was the third? Slight.
I believe there was the escalator, and then there was also the teleprompter. And after making the speech, he said that the sound was completely off in the auditorium where the speech was made. That world leaders, unless they used interpreters' earpieces, couldn't hear a thing.
Huh. It was an escalator and not elevator.
Yeah, you know who was
so like so. You know if it stops, then yeah, it becomes works. Stairs.
Just yeah. as the Trump,
which Melania just went right up the
that's
stairs.
That's what I was just going to say. She did exactly the yeah. right thing. She didn't screw around. She just kept walking. Yeah, that's all you needed to do. Why waste your time being angry about this?
Yeah, that really is the push pull door being stopped. Yeah, I mean, that was a satire article, but
that's it. That was.
It's an indignity to have to take stairs with your own 2 feet.
Well, the image of him and her on the escalator brings to immediate mind the escalator going the other direction when he first announced.
Yes, and gold. We should mention. All right, let's go to other issues making news and things that we want to address on today's program.
Well, I do think that the teleprompter situation is news, not because of the teleprompter, but because of the, like, verbal diarrhea that happens when there is not a teleprompter to give the president boundaries. And, I mean, it was quite a tremendous speech. I think everyone on the planet should listen to it because it really sheds light
work of
on
art, truly.
Truly a work of art. It really sheds
you mean
light
tremendous
on,
favorably?
On how he thinks about us as Americans who he is the president over,
right,
and how he thinks about the world and other people's nations. I mean, I think it really does pull back some of the shine that the party does attempt to keep on
it's,
the president.
It's full throttled anger and hatred that's sort of on display, that is on display. And it was expected to be 15 minutes. It turned out being close to an hour, 54 minutes, I believe.
Yeah, they're supposed to be 15 minutes. Not that they expected he'd do it, but that was...
No. Yeah. And then also I read, and I do not know if this is true. I've tried to fact check this, and I'll try to do a better job, but that the actual... It is the administration that is responsible for the teleprompter in the sense of loading it with the latest remarks to make sure that it's up to date with the latest. The fact that there was a problem there, I don't know ultimately who is to blame for that.
But it shouldn't matter, right? The president of the United States should be able to give a coherent speech.
Which Bill Clinton did when his teleprompter broke. He went completely, he just did the speech.
You just do the speech. I mean, you should have some sense of, like, the top three things you got to get out, and then you stop.
Well, I know this is a cheap shot, but, I mean, yes, except for the fact that I think even if he stuck to the teleprompter, I'm not sure you're going to have coherence. Right? I mean, you know.
But, like, as the president, the president should be able to give a five-minute, he should be able to give a five-minute speech. If you're
right,
a president, you should be able to give a five-minute speech. Yeah. You should be able to make your top three points and then stop and then walk away. Or a handler should be there giving him a hand signal like, stop there, knock it off. And none of those things happen on the world stage.
Well, like, unfortunately, I think you're asking for too much with this president.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, needs to be trained, and that's the one of the problems.
Well, it also resurrects the, I can't remember exactly the origin. I want to say it was in the early 50s, but the phrase, the ugly American. I mean, here's a guy who, his country hosts the United Nations, and he's arguably the most powerful leader in the world, certainly the most powerful leader in that room. And he goes off and he says, your countries are going to hell, and whatever other invectives he could come up with. And that's the ugly American, coarse and vile and loud.
Came through the 1958 book, The Ugly American. So,
what one year in the 50s?
58.
Yeah.
Yep. 1958.
Yeah, right.
All right. Let's go to another story that has made news this week and continues to make news over the what the New York Times in their headline calls Trump's surreal Tylenol guidance, worrying pregnant women. The administration's guidance to avoid Tylenol and, quote, tough it out, prompted anxiety, especially for expectant women who face painful health conditions. When the burning nerve pain in her back and legs gets very bad, Lucy Martinez, who is 27 weeks pregnant, reaches for Tylenol. It helps. Ms. Martinez of Pocatello, Idaho, shattered one of her vertebrae in a snowboarding accident in January. A few months later, she found out that she was pregnant. She stopped taking heavy painkillers and has been managing her pregnancy and her recovery simultaneously ever since. On bad days, The pain is unbearable, so she was confused and upset on Monday when President Trump encouraged pregnant women to tough it out without Tylenol. He claimed that acetaminophen, and you have to hear him.
Yeah, he didn't. He didn't claim it.
Let's see how we do this.
You have to hear him try to pronounce acetaminophen. The active ingredient in Tylenol could be a cause of autism, even though doctors say it is safe in moderation. Ms. Martinez immediately contacted her doctor, asking whether she should continue taking the pain medication after hearing that it was okay. She still called her mother in tears, overwhelmed by the fear of being blamed for whatever might go wrong. Don't take it, Mr. Trump said of Tylenol at a White House briefing. Fight like hell not to take it. He pointed to exceptions in rare instances like dangerously high fevers. The link to is to autism, and saying that if they if there is a link between taking Tylenol during pregnancy and autism, even though most scientists say that this is not the case, and and most doctors still recommend, as Ms. Martinez's doctor has done, still recommend Tylenol as the drug of choice. Catherine, I know you've done some work on this. Give us a sense of what you've investigated when it comes to autism and this medication.
Yeah. So to reiterate, there is definitely no scientific evidence to support a relationship between acetaminophen, Tylenol, and autism. And yes, doctors still recommend Tylenol and acetaminophen to pregnant people to manage fevers. And while there's no evidence of it being linked to autism, we do have a lot of evidence that, you know, fevers are dangerous to pregnancies. So asking pregnant people to tough it out is itself really bad medicine. That we have scientific data for. So why is the health secretary and Trump trying to manufacture a relationship between acetaminophen and autism, between vaccines and autism, right? Why are they supporting the use of leucovorin to treat autism, which is not a sound treatment? So I spent years studying vaccine skeptics within the autism advocacy world, and I published a book on it last year. So what we're seeing is largely an effort to shift the way people understand autism. Right now, the consensus among researchers is that multiple things can contribute to autism. We don't know. There's no single bullet answer. It is a combination of genetics, environment, biology, but we don't have a precise answer yet. And what is happening is that RFK Jr. and Trump and their supporters and anti-vaxxers are trying to shift the framework so that autism is understood as a biological condition, meaning it is something that is caused and has physiological a physiological presence. So I'm going to explain why, very briefly, why this is an attractive explanation. So for parents of autistic children, a vaccine-autism relationship is both tragic and at the same time, it presents a lot of hope. So it what it proposes, so the vaccines do not cause autism, that we know. But the belief that it does suggests that you had a perfectly healthy, beautiful baby that was then injured by vaccines, right? That's the belief. So that sounds horrible. Why would someone want to hang on to that, right? It also inflicts blame on the parents for consenting to vaccines. So the reason why is that if you believe that vaccines cause autism, the next step, right? The rest of us, we're like, oh my God, this is a public health nightmare. But really for parents, the next step in that belief, in that line of logic, is that something can be done about it. If we can pinpoint the cause, then we can figure out the treatment. And this is why there are all of these things like leucophore and all of these treatments that are being proposed. It is based on the idea that there is a cause and now we can do something to reverse it. The broader movement, you know, has holds a lot of distrust against governments, against medical experts. You know, they talk a big game about big pharma, but we should also be very fearful of big quackery. That is an industry too. So there is a lot of money to be made in a vaccine autism relationship. It means new patents can be made on single-dose vaccines or vaccines that are deemed safe by this administration, right, and by the health secretary. There's a lot of money to be made in testing and trying to identify how a child has been injured by vaccines. There's a lot of money in the experimental quackery treatments that are used. And there are so many. When I was doing my research at that time, yes, there was leucovorin was hot, but so were like antifungals, antivirals, Namenda, parasite therapy, hyperbaric chamber therapy, hormone therapy, experimental stem cells. And every year there are more and more treatments that are being released to the market. And none of it is scientifically sound, or there's no scientific evidence supporting any of these treatments. But parents, you know, they are desperate. They understand that living in the United States is a horrible place for disabled people. Like, we don't care about disabled people. And so they understand that they're in a tough situation. So, of course, they're going to try to take advantage of these treatments, right? And parents who were not anti-vax before having a child, they become anti-vax because this understanding allows them a pathway forward, allows them new interventions that they can reach to help their children.
We're gonna let's just pause there and take in what Catherine has shared with us, and we will be back in just a moment, and we'll finish up and talk more about this. We welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Right before break, we were talking about the president making the announcement on Monday to not take Tylenol, which he kept on specifically saying Tylenol, but ultimately acetaminophen, which is in other medications other than Tylenol. However, that there's a link to autism and should not be taken. And he made the point many times of not to take it, and it was not needed, even though science seems to indicate otherwise, as Catherine outlined before before we went to break. When it comes to the skepticism, is this something? This is probably a bigger question, but I just wonder, skepticism in vaccines has been around for a long time.
Oh, it's been around for as long as vaccines.
But then with social media and sort of the fact that it can spread so quickly, I mean, that does have an effect, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And really, during COVID, mm-hmm. it just imploded. And part of that is, yes, social media spreading misinformation about COVID, about the COVID vaccine. And really, up until COVID, anti-vaccine sentiments were, in the United States at least, concentrated among parents, right? We often, most of the conversations revolved around vaccination for school entry. And then during COVID, these ideas broadened to not, you know, people who aren't parents, to people who were concerned about the new COVID vaccine that was coming out. And it was entangled in conversations about personal liberty, what we owe to each other, right? And conversations about risk, because this was a new technology. So there were a lot of things that propelled these worries so that it's as big as they are now.
I think it's kind of a reflection. Vaccines were so good at eliminating yes. life-threatening diseases that people are like, well, we don't need it because that yeah. disease doesn't exist. Yeah. But that's
it's really a
not
testament.
The case.
Yeah.
I think on the topic of autism, and we were talking in the break about mm-hmm. kind of the impact of the language being used around who's to blame and whether it needs a cure in the first place. Autism cannot be cured. It doesn't need
that's
a right. cure. Yeah. That neurodiversity and autism have always existed.
That's
and
right.
And this administration is attempting to sort of fix a problem that doesn't exist instead of creating a more inclusive and supportive yeah. society, right? And what I'm largely concerned with is the impact on the ever-growing move to criminalize women who have who are being blamed for the results of their care, right?
Yeah.
So
it's also cheaper to blame women.
Yeah. It's also cheaper to blame
right?
women,
right?
It's
so much cheaper than, I mean, so much cheaper to say, oh, this is a result of your personal choices. And we don't, you know, we are absolved from building infrastructure and institutions and policies to support disabled people. And, you know, what really, and this, you know, you brought up really nicely, like autism has always been around. Developmental disabilities have always been around. So what is going on? There, you know, the reason why it seems like, you know, these numbers are jumping so quickly and so high is because we have had greater awareness. We have had major changes to the diagnostic criteria, which has expanded the people who are eligible for a diagnosis. We have also, if we want to talk about environmental things, there have been, you know, changes in, you know, we see increased parental age for both mother and father, right? So there are a number of things contributing to this growth that we're seeing. Also things like deinstitutionalization. It used to be that you would just cram a bunch of people into state hospitals and they were away from the public eye. But since deinstitutionalization, people have returned to the community and it has become more important to differentiate disabilities so that we can provide people appropriate care. So that's why we're seeing increased rates of autism, because before you used to be called something else, right? Or there wasn't much effort to differentiate because everyone was given the same treatment.
They were also not allowed to reproduce
through
eugenic efforts, yeah. right? I mean, at least a dozen U.S. states have initiated criminal prosecutions against women for drug use during pregnancy, including mm-hmm. marijuana, by applying existing laws. Other states have adopted new laws to prosecute women who engage in chemical endangerment, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a statute. And so when you reclassify a safe medication mm-hmm. as a medication that can endanger a fetus, you increase the chances that a prosecutor will use the existence of that in that person's bloodstream
right.
to pursue criminal charges if that child is born with some complications.
Mm-hmm.
Already, women in South Carolina, Georgia, Ohio, Arkansas, Texas, Mississippi, Oklahoma, and several other states face criminal charges after a miscarriage or stillbirth for failing to seek immediate medical treatment. Namely, mind you, in those states, medical treatment is largely not available, extremely mm-hmm. expensive, or very far away. Or not pursuing prenatal care, which many parents don't. They don't know they're pregnant necessarily mm-hmm. through some part of their pregnancy, or do not have access, cannot take time off, or don't have funding for it. And not pursuing or disposing of fetal remains in a way that the law enforcement or prosecutors consider improper. So you have a miscarriage early on in your pregnancy, and most women have miscarriages and often don't know that they've had a miscarriage.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it's
right.
a heavy menstrual cycle to
right.
a lot of people. But if a prosecutor believes that you've disposed of that remains improperly, you can be prosecuted for how you did that with your own body. And then we have 41 states with abortion bans that criminalize abortions or the attempt of an abortion or anything that looks like you tried to have an abortion. So, like, when we add treatments, medications to the list of things or reasons to blame women for what happens to a fetus, we increase the chances that some woman will be prosecuted
mm-hmm.
for for taking Tylenol.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, to me, that's what's, it is scary, the language that's happening around autism, but it is scary the way we continue to blame women and criminalize women for what happens in our bodies.
Mm-hmm. This is... I'm reading The Handmaid's Tale for my interview with Margaret Atwood. I mean, and this is it, right?
Yeah.
This is what we're talking about. I'm struck by something, and I don't know if any of you have the answer to this. And again, this is one of those things that's my homework. I have to look it up. But the administration put out a report, and RFK Jr. put out a report a week and a half, 2 weeks ago on autism, and never mentioned this. And then during the press conference on Monday, which seemed hastily arranged, the president at one point said, we were just talking back and we said, well, why don't we just do it now? Let's just do it now. We'll go out and we'll just do it now. And that just struck me as like, what is, so I don't know what the motive is. I don't know exactly what, John Stewart had a great line on Monday night, and he said Tylenol from here on out known as plaintiff number one. of what the motive is.
I mean, I think that Nick just really laid it out. Yep.
I mean, I agree. It doesn't seem, yes, but it doesn't seem
I think he was just latching onto, I think they were having a conversation. He just latched onto this because RFK, the bigger fish he's trying to fry is vaccines, right? And so he said that this month, September, they were going to release, you know, this big report showing a relationship between vaccines and autism. That was going to be the thing. And that's the thing that he has been pushing for so long. And I think this might be one of those things in which, you know, he's listing all the risks and that he believes contribute to autism. And then Trump latched onto this one and just blurted it out. And now we have to all deal with it. I think that's what's going on, because the bigger thing was going to be this report that focused on vaccines. And so now we're dealing with that. And then we're also dealing with acetaminophen. And so it's a lot of messages happening at the same time.
All kind of
contributing to the same understanding of how autism is caused.
Well, right? I also think there was a little bit of a hiccup in the way the administration announced that people should wait to give babies hepatitis vaccines.
Yeah.
And that to save face on that poorly released language, they were like, well, also over here, like,
yeah, distraction,
you know, distraction, like, yes. but it's really acetaminophen. Right. And I think, you know, I'm trying to find the article. I think there is also some connection to one of the scientists who's replaced the real scientists, having a lawsuit related to acetaminophen and autism, and having a financial interest in the government saying that his case was correct in the first place, which he had lost. And I just can't find the article.
All right.
It's always about the money.
It is. Follow the money. We're out of time. My thanks to all of you. You're wonderful. Catherine, Emily, how are you? Thank you.
I'm good.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Did that go okay? You were happy. Nick, thank you so much. Ira, always a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Joe.
All right. We'll be back right after this.